turn to Daniel chapter 6. Daniel chapter 6. We touched on this last night, but I said I would go back to it and give ourselves a chance to make a few additional comments on it and then entertain any comments you might have before we move to chapter 7 and 8, which is really our text for tonight. In Daniel chapter 6, we find Daniel now under the control of the Medo-Persian Empire, and the 70-year reign is beginning to wind down, depending upon when you believe it began or ended, and we'll talk a little bit about that. We may be real close to the ending of that, but this is most known as Daniel in the lion's den. And we made several comments last night. One of them we made is that the reason Daniel would bow down and pray toward Jerusalem was because of a commandment the Lord gave the children of Israel in 1 Kings chapter 8 when Solomon was dedicating the temple, said, if the children are ever in a foreign land, let them bow down toward this city. How often did Daniel pray? 3 times a day. How often have we prayed today? Now, don't answer that, but it's just food for thought. Here's a man that was literally the top appointed official in this land. They had 3 presidents, and he was the top president, and yet he took time every day on set times to pray. Now, that was a Jewish tradition. I understand that. And we're not commanded to do it specifically that way, but it's been my experience that when we don't set aside specific times in the day to pray, what can happen very easily is the day passes by and we're getting ready to go to bed and maybe we haven't gone to the Lord yet. So I think there is some real wisdom in having a structured prayer life, both in terms of times. And I personally think it's wise to even write down our prayers so that we can more thoughtfully go to the Lord. The whole book of Daniel is just full of prayers. That would be an interesting study. Chapter 2, Daniel's praying. Chapter 6, Daniel's praying. Chapter 9 that we hope to get to tomorrow night, the first 2/3 of that entire chapter is a prayer of Daniel's. And we'll try to talk a little bit about this. I made comment last night that one of the ironies of this is that the people who had conspired against Daniel when Daniel wasn't consumed by the lions in the lion's den, that the king was so relieved that he went back, and you might note in verse 24 of Daniel chapter 6 that not only the accusers of Daniel but the wives and children of those were thrown into the lion's den. Now, we don't know how many people there was, but let me give you, I think, a relatively good guess. In the first verse of Daniel chapter 6, it says there were 120 princes, and in verse 2 says there were 3 presidents. I don't think it takes much stretch of the imagination to assume that probably almost all, if not all, of those people were against Daniel because they were jealous of him. So if you take that number of 122 leaders, and let's just assume they were monogamous, which may not be true at all, but let's just assume they only had one wife. Now we're up to almost 250. If they had 2 or 3 children per family, I think it's no stretch to say that thrown into the lion's den were probably a minimum of 500 people and could have well been up to 1,000 without any stretch of the imagination. So this was quite an ordeal when the king's wrath was turned back on these people. And remember, we made the analogy there to what happened to Haman when he built the gallows for Mordecai in the book of Esther, only to be hung on his own gallows. It seems like poetic justice to us, and I guess in one sense it was. The Lord always has the last say. That's one of the great lessons in Daniel chapter 6. Man can connive, and man may even think he's getting away with it, and in a relative period of a life, it may appear that man is getting away with it, but God will always have the last say. He has an incredibly long pencil, as one man wrote, and he never forgets that which man does against him, but he has an even greater eraser that when we ask for forgiveness, he casts it aside. Okay. It seems to me that one or the other, and this is the last comment I wanted to make on chapter 6, is what a need there has always been for men and women who put their physical safety and their physical comfort second to doing the will of God. Daniel did not know for sure that the lions wouldn't eat him, any more than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew for sure that they would not be consumed in the fire. But all four of those men knew that even if death came, death is not the worst. Oh, if we could get over the concept that death is so terrible. To a Christian, death is not bad. It's really something to be longed for. Now, if you're not a Christian, that's another story. We all understand that. But once we put the fear of death secondary to other things, then there's no limit to what we can do. And I love that verse in Hebrews that says, Christ removed the fear of death. That is a tremendous blessing that I believe the Lord gave Daniel, and I believe through the Holy Scriptures He's trying to give us. Any comments or questions on Daniel chapter 6? It's a story you're very familiar with, and again, we could spend a long time on it, but we won't get into some of the tougher passages that are lying ahead of us, and I feel like I owe it to you to at least make an effort to get to those. Okay, on to our text for tonight, which is chapters 7 and 8. Those of you that were with us last night, this is the same sequence that I had up there. If you weren't with us, what that is a chapter with one or two words about some of the main concepts, and then an attempt to get very close to the dates of when those chapters were. And you can see that by the time we get through the first six chapters of Daniel, we've spanned almost 70 years, and Daniel has gone from being a 15-year-old to probably an 85, 86-year-old man. In essence, it's his life. Now what we want to do is go back and take a look at chapters 7 and 8. And the reason I put this diagram on the board is you have to understand that the book of Daniel, after we get through Daniel chapter 6, does not necessarily go in chronological order. For instance, chapter 7 occurred before chapters 5 and 6. And I'll point out to you why we know that. Probably chapter 7 occurred somewhere around 555 B.C. and chapter 8 occurred about 2 years later in 553 B.C. Now these are visions that Daniel had. So the exact date that they occurred isn't necessarily crucial to our understanding, but we're going to notice that in this seventh chapter, Belshazzar is still ruling. Well, Belshazzar was a Babylonian king, and in chapter 5, Belshazzar's life ended and lost the kingdom. So we know that chapter 7 sequentially had to occur prior to it. And if you can kind of envision the book of Daniel, go back and envision chapter 2, which had the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar that had the gold and the silver and the brass and the iron in that statue. And we said that was those four world empires. And you remember what those empires were? Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Well, chapter 7 is going to go back and give us more detail on those four kingdoms. It's almost as if chapter 2 was Nebuchadnezzar's kind of view, but chapter 7 is God's view. Now, they both came from God. I understand that. But we get more detail. Now, some of you, and I've tried to make this as painless for you so far as I could, but from Daniel chapter 7 on, you almost have to study it with the Bible in one hand and a history book in the other hand. And if you don't like history, you're going to have to swallow a little bit of it. I'll try to make it as plain and as simple, because I don't think the book of Daniel, any more than the book of Revelations, needs to be complicated. I believe it often is made complicated for a couple of reasons. Number one, if you convince the audience it's complicated, then they're going to lean on the teacher to explain it to them more. And people just shy away from it. But there's no reason to shy away from the last part of Daniel, nor Revelation. But I will, on occasion, maybe read a little bit of history, because I do want to whet your appetite for that. Okay, chapter 7, let's look at verses 1 and 2. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head bent upon his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matters. Now Belshazzar began ruling in 556 B.C. and ruled, I believe, until 539. So this was in that first year. So I'm putting it at 555 or 556, depending upon whether you count this part of his first year or after his first year. I have one more handout, and I might ask a couple of people, Mark and Lowell. Oh, I got two Marks. I'll let you have rest. I've got 100 of these, and I think that ought to be enough. If it's not, we'll make more. But rather than me put this on the board and you squint and try to read it, I just made a copy of this, and I guess I ought to keep one. Because Daniel chapter 7 and Daniel chapter 2 are very parallel. The symbols are different, but the message is the same. And in essence, Daniel chapter 8. So when you get a chance to look at this in a little bit, we'll go down through it, and I think it will help us understand what we're wanting to get out of this. While they're handing them out, let me just make a comment. Why is it important to study these prophecies? Can you be saved and not understand Daniel chapter 7? Sure you can. You can be saved and not understand the book of Revelation. But I think these prophecies in the last half of Daniel are extremely important, because what we have going on here is God is prophesying what is going to happen centuries in the future. And as you would expect, he hits the nail on the head every time. When people ask me, why do I believe the Bible is true? For me, the number one reason, it's not the only reason, the number one reason I believe the Bible is true is its prophetic accuracy. There are roughly 660 prophecies in the Bible. 330 of them, right at half of them, are about Jesus. Every one of them, except the second coming of Jesus, that is about Jesus, has already happened, and they've happened exactly as the Bible would say. I just want you to keep that in mind as we go through these chapters. How in the world could Daniel, in 550 or 540 B.C., write with accuracy things that were going to happen 400, 600, 1,000 years from now and never miss it? Well, in my mind, there's only one way he could do it. And that is, his visions were inspired. And even the atheist has to admit that Daniel, the book of Daniel, was written when the Bible says it was. There's no question about that. Absolutely no question about that. And so it is really beyond me how any serious student of Bible prophecy can see its time after time accuracy and then question or say that it's been written by men. But I guess if you're bound and determined to reject the holy word of God, you're going to do it no matter what. Okay, thank you, Lowell. On this handout, you just have the four kingdoms down along the side here. And then in chapter 2, you'll notice that it indicates that Babylon was referenced or symbolized by gold. Medo-Persia was symbolized by silver. Greece was symbolized by brass, and Rome was symbolized by iron. Now in chapter 7, in Daniel's dream, under the reign of Belshazzar, we're going to see the same four kingdoms, but they're going to be referred to as, and you see it there, a lion, a bear, a leopard, and a beast. And then when we get to chapter 8, we'll narrow that down a little bit, and he will talk specifically about Medo-Persia and Greece. And the symbolism there will be a ram and a he-goat. So as we go through this, there's no need for you to get unduly confused by the different symbols, and at least this helps me kind of keep it straight. Okay, I won't read this entire chapter, but I do want to go down through it and make some comments about some specific verses. Now, once we get through with chapter 7, we're going to see a slight shift in focus, and I place this here. In chapter 7, and in the vision so far, it's been a focus on the world empires, the Gentile world empires. Once we get to chapter 8 through chapter 12, the focus will then be more on how do these empires affect the Lord's people. And really, that's what John continues in the book of Revelation. How do the empires of the world affect the Lord's people? Okay, let me just read a few verses. If you have your Bibles, I think it will be profitable for you to follow down through them. And then I'll make a few comments and answer questions, and we'll also try to manage our time. Verse 2, Daniel spake and said, and then he's going to say what he saw in the vision. I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. Now the four winds in the Bible in prophecy, usually are symbolic of destruction. So he saw four powerful destructive forces, and they strove upon the great sea. Now that phrase great sea probably has a double meaning. We would immediately think of that being the Mediterranean Sea. Do you realize that the entire Old Testament took place right around the Mediterranean Sea? And in the entire Old Testament, there's only one man we're ever told was on the Mediterranean Sea. You know who that was? Jonah. All of it took place right around it, but that's the only time anyone was on it. But in Revelation chapter 17 and verse 15, it talks about the sea being people. And I think that same symbolism may fit here. These empires rose up out of the masses of people. Okay? And I think that's a good way to understand that verse. Verse 3, and four great beasts, these four beasts were these four empires, and we're going to see them symbolized by these four animals, came up from the sea, and they were different. Each one was different. And remember in chapter 2 we talked about how it was a devolution? They got less noble as it went on, from gold to silver to brass to iron, but we're going to see it again here in chapter 7. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. A lion being ferocious and strong, and eagle's wings signifying the ability to move fast in various directions. Wings usually in prophecy connotates mobility, and this would have been mobility of the army. And I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked. Now what happens to a beast when their wings are plucked? They're no longer able to fly. They become ineffective. This plucking of the wings was prophetic of the loss of the power of this empire of Babylon. And it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand upon feet as a man, and man's heart was given to it. In other words, it once had the power of a lion, and it's reduced to simply having the power of a man. The decline and the fall of the Babylonian Empire that we saw a couple of chapters ago. Verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second to it like a bear, and it raised up itself on one side and had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. Now this beast, this bear, is Medo-Persia. And this raising up on one side would indicate one side was stronger than the other. And in fact, the Persian side of the Medo-Persian Empire was by far the dominant. And I think that's what we have referring to here. In chapter 8, we have it explained a little bit differently, but it's the same concept. It was a Medo-Persian Empire, but it was the Persian side of that empire that was truly strong. And in its mouth, it had three ribs. This was a tremendously cruel empire, and these three ribs probably represent three of the large countries that it had devoured. Specifically, I think these three countries were Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon. When you go back through history, those were the three major powers that the Medo-Persians had to conquer to become a world power. So you have this picture of this huge bear with these countries as ribs still in their mouth with the carnage still dripping off. And you can visualize that in whatever detail you choose to. Verse 6, "And I beheld, and another like a leopard, which was upon the back of it four wings of a fowl, and the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." This leopard represents, and it's explained to us later in chapter 7, but I'm just giving you the explanation as I go, was Greece. And the wings, again, had to deal with the speed and the thrust of the military. And the leader of Greece, as they conquered, was Alexander the Great, who died when he was 32 years old. All the great conquering Alexander the Great did it in a 12-year span. We don't have time to do it, and Alexander the Great was not divine, but if you go back and study Alexander the Great, there's the great comparison between his life and Christ's in things they accomplished and the way they did, and almost even the age at which they died. And on it was four heads. What happened when Alexander the Great died was his four generals took over, divided the kingdom into four. And if you look on the handout, not that handout, but the big handout I gave you, in chapter 8, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but in chapter 8, the sixth bullet, the four generals of Alexander the Great that took over upon his death were Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassander, and Lysimachus. Well, of those four, Ptolemy and Seleucus were the strongest. The other two just faded. If you wonder where Hellespont is, it's a little peninsula up there around the Adrian Sea, but it's just very insignificant. It's very insignificant, and they faded. Now, Ptolemy became the leader in Egypt, and Seleucus became the leader in Syria. And that's going to be important when we get to chapters 8 and 11, because there is constant conflict between those two. But I just point to that to show you what these four heads were, in my opinion, and then chapter 8 will give us more detail about it. Now, remember, none of this has happened. This is God telling them exactly what's going to happen. He's telling them what empires are going to lead. And he's even telling us that Alexander the Great's kingdom is going to be divided amongst four people. And this is at least 200 to 250 years before it happened. How could Daniel have known that? Only one way. Only one way. Okay. Verse 7. "After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast." This beast was so dreadful, it's not even given an animal. It's just called a beast. "Dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth," symbolic back of the iron feet that we saw in chapter 2. "And it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And we know from history that this fourth beast was the Roman Empire. The 10 horns referred to, and that's T-E-N, not T-I-N. The 10 horns referred to there were the 10 tribes that were the major components of the Roman Empire. They later became the countries that we typically think of in Europe, Spain, France, Germany, and so forth. But there were 10 tribes, and you find this exact same wordage and description when you go to the book of Revelation. Okay? Verse 8, "I considered the horns, and behold, there came up from among them another little horn." Now, out of these 10 horns came up another one, and it wasn't there to begin with, but it rose up, this little horn, "before whom there were three, and the first horns plucked up by the roots." The little horn in verse 8, I believe, is in reference to the papal system, or the apostate church, Rome, the Roman church, whatever you want to call it. Because it rose up out of this Roman Empire. When you go back and look at history, the Roman Empire's military power ended in about 475 B.C., but the papal power of the church really began in about 532 B.C. And it went until 792. I said B.C., I meant A.D. It began in 532 A.D. and went until 792 A.D. Did anybody happen to know, this is a trivia, what happened in 792 A.D.? You got to be a history buff, and that's unfair. That was the French Revolution. That was the French Revolution. And we're going to see a little bit later that that really broke the military and political power of the apostate church. It didn't break the church, but it did break its military and political power. Okay, I went down through that and almost did a monologue. Let me stop and see if you have any comments or questions. And again, I know for some of you that's more than you want, and for some of you it's not as much. David? I think the four wings were the speed of the military as it went out and conquered very rapidly. Most of the Greek Empire was conquered in a 12-year span, and that's extremely fast for this day and age, but it was terribly fast back then. They just went like a whirlwind. And they did it because of Alexander the Great. Once he died, it just fell apart. No man's indispensable, but he was about as close to it as you're going to get in a human being. Anybody else? Questions or comments or clarification?
John, was one of the generals,
I think so, but I can't remember which one. I think so, but I can't remember which one. Marvin?
You believe God raised Alexander the Great then for a purpose?
I think it's highly likely. Marvin's question was, do I think God raised up Alexander the Great for a purpose? I think that's highly likely. At least I believe God spread the Greek culture throughout the land for a purpose, and Alexander the Great was the vehicle to do that. And why would God want to do that? Well, he wanted to Hellenize or Greekize as much of the world as he could so that when the New Testament came, people would be able to more clearly understand it. Just like I think God raised up the Roman Empire for a purpose, and that was to build a road system so that Paul and all these people could travel. Had God, remember, it's in Galatians, I believe, where it says God at his appointed time sent his son. You just go back and study history. This was the first time the majority of the world could read the same language. This was the first time you could travel almost unencumbered. It was no accident that Jesus came and the gospel came when it did. If it had come 50 years earlier or 50 years later, Paul and Barnabas and those people couldn't have traveled freely like they did. Absolutely, I believe that. Yeah. Good point. Anybody else? Bobby. I'm sorry? Winds? Winds were the destructive power and destructive force. Wings is speed. Eyes in prophecy is usually human wisdom. And once you kind of go through a few of these, you get some commonalities that help you go through these. Okay, I've got to pick up the pace just a little bit. Now in verse 9, our scene shifts from earth to heaven. We're going to be, it's like Star Trek, beam us up. Well, let's beam up to heaven here in verse 9. And I beheld the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father. So now Daniel, much like John did in Revelation chapter 1, verse 13 through 18, gets a glimpse at God on the throne, and Revelation chapter 4 is God on the throne. He sees this Ancient of Days, and he's portrayed as white and hair of wool, symbolism that we find frequently in the Bible. And around him are these thousands and ten thousands of people worship him, which I think are the heavenly hosts. And then if you'll drop down to verse 13, he also then sees one like the Son of Man, and I believe that's Jesus. He sees in heaven God the Father and God the Son. So if you have any question about was Jesus alive before he was born, this and many other passages, I think, should answer that for you. Daniel saw them in heaven before the incarnation ever took place. Let me just comment on a few things that I wanted to pick up on. Well, let's look, for instance, at verse 21. This is talking about that little horn that I told you in verse 8 was the papal system. We see in verse 21, he sees that horn making war with the saints. This is the persecution of the church. Daniel, prophetically and in through a vision, is seeing that the church is going to be persecuted by the apostate church some 1,000+ years in the future. Okay. Now there's something we need to look at down here in verse 25, and we're going to have to pause just a little bit because it's the first time I know of in the Bible that this concept is introduced, and you will not understand Daniel and you sure won't understand Revelation without it. And he shall speak great words against the Most High and shall wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. That's talking about the papal system, as I understand it. He's going to try to change the laws of God and the ways of God, and they shall give into his hands, now notice this, until a time and times and the dividing of times. That tells us when this great influence of the apostate church is going to end. And I know several of you have been through this, but for those of you that maybe haven't, we need to grasp this time, times, and half times or dividing of times. The reference to time is equal to 1 year. It's therefore times, as it's used prophetically in the plural, is 2 years. And a divided time or a half time is equal to a half a year. So we have 3.5 years. But in biblical prophecy, there's a concept called the day-year theory. Several times in the Bible, the prophecy is such that the Bible uses one day to constitute a year. You remember when the 12 spies went out to spy out the land? Anybody remember how long the 12 spies were gone? 40 days. Anybody remember how long the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness? 40 years. And that's why. Okay? In the book of Ezekiel, he has to lay on his side for 40 days, symbolic of the 40 years of judgment that's going to be put on Judah. Okay? And in the Hebrew, a year was 360 days. So what I believe we're talking about here is 1,260 days. And in prophecy, that would be 1,260 years. Now, if you kind of think he's just going through math fast, and I'm not sure that's right, just kind of bear with me. What I believe this is referring to is the time that the papal system will be in the height of its power. And it parallels very closely to what we call the Dark Ages. And this is real important when you study the book of Revelation, because the papal system really began to consolidate its power in 532 AD and lost its power in 1792 AD. And if I did that right, that's 1,260 years. The significance of the French Revolution for the papal system can't be overemphasized. It's hard for us to understand how that all of these countries were under the thumbnail of the church. You couldn't be appointed king of France unless the Pope appointed you. That's the way it was. Well, with the French Revolution, that changed. And in fact, Napoleon insisted and made the Pope come to France to appoint him. Well, that was a slap in the face, because kings always had to go to Rome to be appointed. And then when Napoleon got the Pope there, he wouldn't let him go home. Now, that just sounds like something kind of petty to us, but that was really rubbing the salt in the wound, and it was a major statement to the rest of the European and Caucasian, or those that were primarily involved with the church at that time, that that power had taken a major shift. Now, that church, that organization, still exists and is still very powerful. I don't mean that, but it's nothing like it was then. And in fairness to that organization, it's not as cruel and as evil today as it was. I mean, there were things that people did in the name of religion that would just chill our spines. And that doesn't go on anymore. I want to be fair. I want to indicate that there's been a lot of changes in that organization, even though I don't agree with its doctrine. But that's what we're talking about here. So in verse 25, when it says that he's going to have this power, he's going to speak, these are what they call papal bulls. And papal bulls are not cattle. They're edicts. Okay? So, because when they make an edict, it's law. These things are going to go on and carry much weight until the end of this 1260 years. And that's what we have reference to. Again, here we've got Daniel prophesying when this is going to end, some 2500 years before it ever happens. And I think that's absolutely tremendous. Any comments or questions on anything that I've covered or on chapter 7 at this point? It's an elucidation of the four empires, but now we get a specific look at things that are going to be happening in the AD era. And when you study the book of Revelations, beginning with chapter 6 through chapter 17, it's really an amplification of what I just told you. And it's not complicated, you just got to sit down and sort it out. Lowell. Where we at?
Verse 12 of 7. It will prolong for a season of time. You're going to equate that with the 7-day year?
Well, you could the time, but you can't really equate the season to a year. I take that combination in verse 12 to simply mean that the rest of these beasts, that would be the Persians and the Greeks, their power has been reduced, but God's going to allow those countries to continue to exist for a period of time. And I don't really know how to get a handle on how long a season is, but their power has been reduced. That's my take on that. Marvin? Yeah. I think there's a lot of things you can say about that, and I can't prove when God does and when God doesn't, but I'm a firm believer that God's finger is on a lot of things that happen providentially. He doesn't make individual people do things, but I think he oftentimes dictates what nations do and what rulers do, and he uses them for his purpose. He did in the Old Testament, and I don't know why to think he stopped. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, your senator is there because God wants him to be. I don't know about that. But in the big scheme of things, I think God has a lot more to do with things than we do. That causes me to worry a lot less about politics than I used to. Besides that, I can't do anything about it. Lowell?
I read a long time ago when I studied Revelation that Mark's asking about the three kings, and I forgot those were three countries that they had trouble with.
That would be probably would be France, Spain, and England. Because they, I don't know about most trouble, but they were the ones most had the greatest control by the Catholic Church at various times. I don't know how to teach this without using the term Catholic Church. I don't want to offend anybody, but I just don't know how to teach it. You know, I can use all kind of code words, but you know what I'm saying. But it is a different organization than today in many ways. I don't agree doctrinally with it today, but it's a much kinder organization today than it was. Let me put it that way, by far, far. Anybody else? What you ought to do as soon as I leave town is rush in and study Revelation. I doubt you will with the 2-week meeting coming up, but it really fits. Because once you got these things under your belt, you can just kind of, well, not smooth through Revelation, but it sure greases the skids. Because the Bible is consistent. Okay, anything else? We'll take a little look at chapter 8. This was a vision that he had 2 years later, because the chapter 7 was in the first year of Belshazzar. Now we're in the third year of Belshazzar. Verse 2, "And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan." Now Shushan later became a capital of the Medo-Persians, but it was also a capital of the province when it was part of the Babylonian. So he was in the capital, kind of the summer capital, Camp David, if you will, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw a vision. And I lifted up my eyes, and behold, there stood in before the river a ram with two horns. Okay? Later on in the chapter, we find out that that ram is Medo-Persia, and the two horns are the Medes and the Persians. Okay? We've got this dual reigning. But notice again that the two horns were high, but one was higher. Just like the bear rolled over on one side because that side was stronger. Now we see the imagery of a ram with two horns, but one horn is larger, representing the Persian side because it was the strongest of the two. "And I saw the ram," verse 4, "pushing westward and northward and southward so that no beast might stand before it." In other words, this Medo-Persian Empire, when it conquered, nobody could stand up to it. Verse 5, "And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat," and later in the chapter he tells us this he-goat was Greece, "came from the west on the face." And you know where Greece is, so it would come from the west down to the Medo-Persian Empire. "Came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground." It was just coming so fast. It was just like his feet weren't even touching the ground. "And the goat had a notable horn." Now, another key in prophecy, horn always, as far as I can recall, stands for power. So this Grecian Empire had a notable power. And I believe that's a direct reference to Alexander the Great. There was no military leader like Alexander the Great. Probably never has been, and probably never will be. And verse 6, "He came to the ram," or Medo-Persia, "that had two horns, which I saw standing by the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power, and I saw him close into the ram, and he was moved with bitterness against him, and he smote the ram and brake the two horns." In other words, Alexander the Great led the Greek army against Medo-Persia and absolutely demolished them. He smashed them. Okay? Verse 8, "Therefore the he-goat," that's Greece, "waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn," that's the same as that notable horn, "broke," reference to the death of Alexander the Great, "and it came, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven." The four notable ones are these four generals that I referenced to you in chapter 5, or chapter 7, Ptolemy, Seleucus, Cassandra, and Lysimachus. And the ones that we'll really need to remember are Ptolemy and Seleucus, because they're the only ones that amounted to anything. Ptolemy became the leader in Egypt, and Seleucus the leader of what we now call Syria. Verse 9. "And out of one of them came forth a little horn." Now, you remember in chapter 7 we had a little horn, and I said that was papal Rome. Well, I don't believe the little horn here is papal Rome. And the reason I don't believe that is in chapter 7 the little horn came out of the Roman Empire. But here we have a little horn coming out of the Greek Empire. And what we have here, and many people, and I concur, is a reference to a man called Antiochus Epiphanes. Now that may not mean too much to us, but let me just give you a little picture of what this man was. He was the eighth king of the Seleucids, or the group that settled in Syria. And he was a terribly, terribly wicked and cruel man. And like many leaders then and today, he was an egomaniac. And in about 175 AD, when he was in his rule, he decided to go down to Egypt and fight the Ptolemies. And to make a long story very short, he went down there and was absolutely humiliated. And military leaders don't like to be humiliated. Well, if you know your map, how do you get from Syria to Egypt? You go right through Israel. That's how you do it, if you want water. So that's what he did. But coming back on his way to Syria with his tail between his legs, he was not a happy camper. And egomaniacs, when they're not happy, pick on people that aren't their own size. And that's exactly what he did. And in 171 A.D., he went into Jerusalem and began tormenting the priest. It's going to tell us about that. He desecrated the temple. He desecrated it to such extent that they put the idol Juniper in the temple and actually sacrificed swine on the Jewish temple altar. Now, you all know enough about the Jewish approach to swine and unclean animals to know that you couldn't do much more to absolutely humiliate them. And this occurred and lasted for about six and a half years, from 171 A.D. to 165. And then a man that you've probably heard of, but may or may not know what he did, by the name of Judas Maccabee, and he and some of his followers wrote some of those books that